Do you solemnly swear that in all things appertaining to the trial of the impeachment of Donald John Trump, President of the United States, now pending, you will do impartial justice according to the Constitution and laws, so help you God?
Chief Justice John Roberts today swearing in all 100 senators as jurors in President Trump's impeachment trial. The trial formally began today. Earlier, House prosecutors marched over to the Senate, where Intelligence Chair and lead prosecutor in the trial, Adam Schiff, read aloud the two charges against President Trump, charges of abuse of power and obstruction of justice. House Democrats will begin presenting their case early next week. Well, what can we expect? Joining us now to discuss all of this is Darren Samuelson. He is senior White House correspondent for Politico. Hi there.
Good afternoon.
Well, a lot of procedural ceremony today. Even the Capitol Police had to dress up and wear ties, which is extraordinary. I just want to play a clip from Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell with his request to Chief Justice Roberts.
I ask unanimous consent that in recognition of the unique requirements raised by the impeachment trial of Donald John Trump, President of the United States, the Sergeant-at-Arms shall install appropriate equipment and furniture in the Senate chamber during all times that the Senate is sitting for trial with the Chief Justice of the United States presiding. The appropriate equipment, furniture, and computer equipment in accordance with the allocations and provisions I now send to the desk and ask that they be printed in the record.
Is there objection? Without objection, so ordered.
Okay, so what is this about special equipment and special furniture?
Yeah, the Senate that we're going to be seeing for the next couple of weeks is definitely not going to be the Senate we are familiar with, anybody who watches C-SPAN on a regular basis. There will be defense and prosecution tables that will be placed there in the well of the Senate, kind of right in the front of it, in front of the seats where the senators sit. And those will be occupied for the next 2+ weeks by the House prosecutors, that team that Nancy Pelosi rolled out yesterday, including Adam Schiff and Jerry Nadler. And then on the other side, we'll see the Trump lawyers sitting there. That's the primary difference that you'll see in terms of watching on television of the Senate procedure. But there are eventually, there could be audiovisual equipment that will be displayed and used on the Senate floor once we get into the nitty gritty of the actual presentations here in the coming weeks.
Yeah, I understand they're not allowed to have their cell phones and they don't get to ask questions verbally. They have to ask them in writing.
That's correct. So anytime they have a question, they will write it down on a piece of paper, hand it to a Senate page. There will be a number of those young people sitting around in the chamber, and the pages will bring them up to the Chief Justice, who will present those questions. This will be a little bit later on in the process once we get to the Q&A portion, which will come after the opening presentations. The senators can, I should say, stand up and speak up if they have procedural objections. So while they are bound to their chairs, there is a very real possibility that during the presentations, a senator can't stand up and make a point of order or raise some other issue. This happened during the Bill Clinton trial early on, where Senator Tom Harkin, an Iowa Democrat, actually did stand up, raise an objection when one of the House Republicans back then was referring to the Senate as a jury, which the Senate Democrat took issue with and said, actually, we are a court, not a jury. And Chief Justice Rehnquist actually upheld that point of order. And from then on, the House managers were no longer allowed to call the senators jurors, which was sort of a small procedural issue. But nonetheless, it was an important one that continues to ripple to this day.
Oh, wow. Interesting. Well, you said that this might last 2+ weeks. Do we know how long it will last for sure?
That is a parlor game. The administration yesterday during a conference call with reporters, a senior official said that they thought it could go fast and would be done in 2 weeks. But this is the United States Senate, which is renowned for taking long periods of time. The Andrew Johnson trial from back in the 1860s, I'm sure we all remember, took a long time. I believe it was like 11 weeks. Mm-hmm. The Bill Clinton trial was over a course of, I believe, about 2 or 3 weeks, but there was a break in the middle. I think that it's anyone's guess. It really depends, I think, on witnesses and whether they open up that Pandora's box. But we're not going to get a decision on witnesses or a vote on witnesses, I should say, until further on in the process, maybe about a week and a half from now. And if they do decide to bring witnesses, You know, that could be everyone from Rudy Giuliani and John Bolton. And if Rand Paul, you know, follows through on the threat he's making, you know, then they could potentially subpoena Joe Biden and Hunter Biden. So things could get crazy up there.
Yeah. Well, how many senators on the Republican side would it take to break ranks and to vote to allow witnesses?
Four Senate Republicans. So,
and are there the votes there? Are there four?
It sounds like there's three right now. Mitt Romney, Lisa Murkowski, and Susan Collins have all signaled they're interested in hearing from witnesses. But, you know, not until that roll call is actually held will we know for sure. And then the question is on a fourth senator. A lot of people are looking to Lamar Alexander, a retiring longtime senator, an institutionalist, a former George H.W. Bush cabinet secretary. He could potentially swing and vote for witnesses. But I think once the presentations are done, there's going to be certainly a lot of pressure, going to be a lot of debate. And I bet Mitt Romney, Susan Collins, Lisa Murkowski will be pleading with their colleagues to open, you know, this up. And yeah, we'll find out in a couple of weeks.
Okay, so let's say they do vote to allow witnesses. Then what happens? Does each side get to call whomever they want?
Well, they can reach an agreement on how many witnesses they want to have. They could limit it to just a couple. They could have it wide open. It's really up to the Senate to decide what the agreement looks like. And, you know, there's not a lot of precedent here. We have two presidential impeachments in American history. In the Bill Clinton example, that is the obviously more recent and better precedent for us. They ultimately only heard from three witnesses, but they decided to do those depositions behind closed doors rather than do them on the Senate floor in a live proceeding. So Monica Lewinsky was one of the three witnesses that they brought forth, but they did that behind closed doors. The Senate Republicans and the Senate at large didn't want Monica Lewinsky on the Senate floor talking about the salaciousness, the relationship she had with Bill Clinton, and to sort of spoil the demeanor of the Senate. And so they did this behind closed doors. They let the senators watch and read the transcripts later. And that's the question here, is whether these witnesses would actually be called publicly in front of us with TV cameras rolling, or they could do these behind closed doors and only release transcripts. That's, again, a decision the Senate will have to make later on down the line.
Right. Well, what about this new information that's come out in recent days? Today, for example, the nonpartisan Government Accountability Office saying the Trump White House violated the law, broke the law, when it withheld aid from Ukraine. That report, so that's information there. And also Lev Parnas as a witness, the Giuliani associate, saying he would love to be a witness in the trial and testify that President Trump did indeed order him or was behind the desire for him to go to Ukraine and try to exact a quid pro quo from Ukrainian officials there.
Yeah, there's been a ton of information that has come out since the House voted in December to impeach the president. And there is a thriving debate about whether that material should be in the record. I would imagine that the House Democratic prosecutors will certainly be talking about all of these things on the Senate floor. There's been some resistance. I think Marco Rubio, among others, has said for the Republican side that the record should only be limited to what was actually discussed and debated during the House impeachment process. But you know, this is not a trial like you would see in a court of law. This is, I think the senators are not going to be cloistered in a way that they can't look at their phones when they leave the Senate chamber and not take into account what they're hearing from in the wider world and what's on television and what they're hearing from their constituents. I mean, that is exactly going back to that original point that I was making about Tom Harkin. And this is a court. They are sort of free to kind of look at public opinion and the political constituencies and the facts that will be presented to them. And those facts could include things that, you know, go beyond what was debated on the House floor last month. It's up to them to really decide what they should consider when they're deciding whether to convict or not to convict. And, looming in the background is there is no double jeopardy clause in the Constitution. So if the Democrats decide that they learn about more high crimes and misdemeanors, if this Lev Parnas information is relevant, they could always impeach Donald Trump again, you know, next month or 2 months from now. Or, you know, if he wins re-election, they could have another impeachment in 2021. So there's no reason to think that the things that we're learning about now are just going to go away when the Senate trial is over.
Wow. Another impeachment. Imagine that. Darren Samuelson, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, how Vladimir Putin is positioning himself to run Russia for a lot longer. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Sweeping changes are taking place in the Russian government right now. One thing will probably remain the same: Vladimir Putin pulling the strings. During his annual address, Putin announced term limits for future presidents, not him, and more power for the parliament. Right after that, Putin's cabinet and principal ministers resigned. Joining us to explain what's happening is Andrew Weiss from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, where he oversees research on Russia and Eurasia. Welcome.
Great to be here.
Well, tell us about these changes Putin announced and why they're significant.
So there's just a step back. Part of what's been going on is that Putin was facing a constitutionally imposed term limit, which would have required him to step down as president in 2024. And the uncertainty that that's created inside the Russian political system and throughout the economy and beyond has become negative for him. And people have been sort of trying to figure out what's going to happen. Is he going to go sit somewhere quietly and write his memoirs, or does he just plan to remain in power indefinitely? And what he did yesterday by rolling out a series of unexpected changes, both constitutional changes, which would be subject to a future popular referendum, plus naming a new government and talking about a whole new structure of political power in the country, was dispel that uncertainty. He basically sent a message to everyone: I'm not going anywhere. I'm going to supervise a transition that will provide for continuity and new faces and competent leadership, but I'll remain in power ultimately as the final arbiter and the final authority. And that, I think, sends a series of messages to the Russian elite that it's not a good time to be lining up behind wannabes or pretenders to the throne. But also, I think, sends a message to the West, which is we're going to have to deal with Vladimir Putin, whether we like it or not. We can't sort of nurture these hopes that, you know, one day maybe he'll you know, fade away.
Yeah.
You know, Vladimir Putin's a pretty young guy. He's not going anywhere.
He's already been in power for, what, 20 years?
It's only been 20 years.
Only. Okay. So how much longer could he be in power when his term is over officially? We're at 2024. These new changes say what exactly in terms of the presidency?
So the presidency, I wouldn't get hung up on, and the term limits for the presidency. What he is talking about is shifting, and he hasn't indicated to where, his perch. And so he isn't tipping his hand about where he's going to end up, but there's a couple of options. The most likely, to my mind, and I'm just freely speculating with you, is he's setting up something similar to what Chinese leader Xi Jinping set up when he announced that he was going to be president for life. And so Putin will become potentially the head of a new state council. There's one currently that's largely dormant that unites the political leadership in Moscow with the regional governors who oversee the broad geographical expanse of the country. He is looking at new arrangements like that, where he would be leader for life and do that without having to stand for office.
Kind of like what he did when Medvedev was president for a minute. He's now the current prime minister, or he was until today. A new prime minister was approved by parliament. So Putin has a history of actually operating the levers, even though he wasn't officially the president.
Yeah, that was a tricky case, though, because just to remind folks, when Putin stepped away, it was a similar situation. You're right that he was term limited out, so he needed to go somewhere else, and he went as prime minister. But during the period he was prime minister and Medvedev was president, Russian foreign policy changed rather dramatically. We had the Obama-Medvedev reset. We had the Russians doing any number of things that are unthinkable today. The world's a very different, far more acrimonious place than it was in 2008 when Medvedev stepped into the presidency. But it wasn't a completely phony set of responsibilities. I think everyone knew at the end of the day Putin had to be consulted and was an important voice and the dominant voice on most decisions. But the thing we also have to remember is that Putin isn't always that hands-on. there's a side of the Russian system that we've built up a mythology about, which, you know, implies that basically no housefly can get out, you know, and buzz around any apartment in Moscow without Putin signing off on it. There's, you know, a fair amount of slippage from what comes off of Putin's desk to what's actually implemented down below him.
Okay, so what are the houseflies buzzing about out in the rest of Russia? The people, do they still support him overwhelmingly, or is there some significant dissent?
Well, there's a lot of structural reasons why, and I don't mean to say Putin's not going anywhere. The country ultimately is somewhat rickety, and there's any number of events that could just pop out and surprise everyone and make the existing political order untenable. But what they've done by design for the past 20 years is clear the playing field. So there's a word in Russian, bezalternativnost, which means without alternatives. And so Putin is the most popular political leader by far because there are no other would-be successors who are allowed to establish a profile that makes you think, oh, that day might finally come for person X to become the head of state. So they are very careful to keep their political system on an extremely managed footing and to make sure that there are as few surprises as possible. That doesn't mean mistakes or surprises don't happen. And so we saw in 2011, 2012, when Putin basically said to people that the Medvedev presidency was largely an artifice, that it just infuriated a lot of middle class and upper class Russians who felt humiliated, and it brought them out to the streets in droves in the street protests of 2011-2012.
And there were demonstrations last year, pretty big ones. So what is it that people aren't liking about him aside from his iron grip on power?
I think people are generally pretty tired of the Putin era, but they also have, there's sort of two elements of this. One is the socioeconomic conditions have not been great, but in the back of most Russians' minds who are sort of, say, middle-aged and older is we've been through a horrible period of turmoil during the Gorbachev and Yeltsin eras. We don't want to do that again. And so there's a kind of better the devil you know and the system you know than throwing everything up for grabs again. That brings with it any number of risks in terms of instability at the top and also carving up again of property and position inside the Russian system. So there's sort of some built-in risk aversion into the current political constellation.
Well, Andrew, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Andrew Weiss, he's with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Well, sticking with Russia this week, a report showed Russian hackers infiltrated the Ukrainian company Burisma using phishing techniques. Burisma is the company Trump has repeatedly tried to have investigated because Joe Biden's son Hunter served on its board. With the presidential election coming up and potentially nefarious forces at work, as they were in 2016, we wanted to take a look at just what phishing is and how you can avoid getting hooked. Joining us now is Cooper Quinton, Senior Staff Technologist at the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Hi.
Hi.
Well, most of us, I think, are familiar with phishing at this point, where we receive an unsolicited email, we click on a link, and then, lo and behold, we're hacked. Do we know when that happens? Do we know when we're hacked when we click on these emails?
You might not necessarily know that you've been hacked as soon as you click on the email. It might take a little bit. A lot of phishing campaigns are trying to get credentials to your email account or to other sensitive accounts. Some of them are trying to get you to download and install malware. And it might take a while for that to become apparent.
So give us an example of a common phishing technique that we might not know is a phishing technique.
Sure. So some of the most common ones that we see are an email will come that looks like it came from Google, and it'll say something like, your account has been compromised. Please click here to reset your password. You'll click that link, and it'll take you to a page that looks like a Google login, but is in fact a completely different website altogether. And when you type in your login info, that login information gets sent to an attacker, to a scammer, and then you get redirected to the real Google site unbeknownst to you.
So when you are phished, Does a phishing email usually come from something that looks official, like something you can't tell is fake?
There are many different types of phishing. Some of them look like an official email from, say, Google or FedEx or Microsoft. Others might look something like what we call a sextortion scam, where the attacker will send you an email that says they have some compromising video of you looking at adult websites, and you have to pay them some amount of Bitcoin to get them to delete that video, when in fact they don't have any such video and they're just sending these out hoping that people will pay up. Those
But is that just a scam rather than phishing? Is that just like someone trying to extort you out of money?
That is just a scam, certainly, but the line between scams and phishing is not quite as well defined as one might hope.
And how often are normal people phished versus institutions or public officials or the DNC, for example?
So again, it depends what type of phishing you're talking about. There are two main types of phishing that we talk about when we're talking about this, and it's targeted attacks and untargeted attacks. So the untargeted attacks might look like the ones that I've described so far. You know, things like your Google account has been compromised, or the old classic Nigerian prince that has a lot of money he wants to give to you scam. Those are the sort of untargeted phishing attacks. Another common one that we see is you have a package waiting for you at FedEx, but you need to download this PDF to find out what it is. And that PDF actually contains malware. The other kind are targeted attacks, and these can ramp up in sophistication to be pretty highly sophisticated. So probably the most famous example of a targeted phishing attack is the one that was sent to the DNC and back around the 2016 election, or the most recent one that was sent to Burisma. Those are much less common, and most people will never be the recipient of one of those in their lifetime. But some people that work for companies which are under geopolitical scrutiny, people that work in politics, people that are activists or journalists or human rights defenders, especially that are working to protect people under authoritarian governments, those people are at a much higher risk of getting these sort of targeted attacks.
So how do they, and how do we, protect ourselves?
So my main piece of advice for protecting yourself against phishing is to use the same, for lack of a better term, use the same spidey sense that you would use to alert yourself to scams that happen in real life, right? If something seems off about an email, if something seems off about a text message, you know, if it makes your hair stand on end, listen to that instinct. And in general, if you get a link or an attachment in an email that you weren't expecting, even if it's from somebody that you know, don't click on it right away. Contact the person in another way, give them a call, and make sure that they did in fact intend to send that to you.
So don't click on attachments that you don't know what they
are. Yeah, and don't click on links that you don't know what they are.
Okay, so don't click on things.
So, and that's the first
that
one
you receive unsolicited. Don't. Okay, so that's
yes,
good.
Yes.
Don't click. Okay, that's good.
That's the first line of defense. And then the second line of defense is what I would call basic digital security hygiene. So this is things like keeping all of your software up to date, installing security updates on your phone and on your laptop when they become available, using a password manager, and turning on two-factor authentication for any sites that have it available.
Okay, well, let's say we didn't do that. And let's say we did click on that attachment. And let's say we are now infiltrated. What next?
Yeah, at that point, if you opened the attachment and it ran and your antivirus didn't pick it up and stop it, then you may have some malware on your system. And once you figure that out, my advice is that you take your computer to a professional and have them help you clean it up. My other advice is that you always keep backups of the important data on your computer, because the most common type of malware that we see being installed through phishing attacks right now is ransomware, which will encrypt your data and hold it for ransom until you pay. So having backups means that this will be a much less devastating attack than it could be. You know, you're not going to lose all of your family photos and all of your music and everything that you've downloaded and worked on over the years.
Cooper Quinton, Senior Staff Technologist at the Electronic Frontier Foundation in San Francisco. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up, a big pay increase for WNBA players, which could ripple out to all professional female athletes.
As much as we fight for what we feel that we deserve, we know that we deserve, we have women's soccer, we have women's hockey that are looking up to what we are looking to do.
LA Sparks star Nneka Ogwumike is here next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Want to make $100,000 a year? Well, you could be an air traffic controller, you could be a software developer, you could be a nurse practitioner, or you could apply at your local Taco Bell. Known for its greasy stoner food, Taco Bell announced a pilot program for its managers to make white-collar salaries. Here with the details is Leslie Patton. She covers food and restaurants for Bloomberg. Hi there.
Yes, hello.
Well, so what do they pay their managers now?
Well, that is a good question. It varies widely across the industry for franchisees and for company, but, you know, probably 15, 20 bucks an hour. You know, the company says they do a little higher, so maybe around 50, 60, 70,000 a year. But this is a big bump either way, right?
Yeah, completely. So what's behind the idea?
Well, we have a massive labor shortage in the country, especially for low-wage workers. And there's the whole argument, well, these companies, these franchisees should just pay more. And so maybe we're starting to see that actually happen, that come to fruition. That being said, this is just a test, so I guess they'll see how it goes.
It's a test in, what, one store or a couple stores? How widespread?
I think it's just in a handful of locations, and it's at the company-owned one, so no franchisees are doing this yet, because presumably they would have to raise menu prices then if they're going to pay their employees this much more. And then it's like, well, are people going to pay more for their dollar tacos? I don't know. I don't know the answer to that.
Yeah. Well, so I guess there's also a trickle-down effect. If the managers are making $100,000, then the other workers would make more, too?
Presumably that would be the case. You would think so. And then maybe some of these people would have more spending money, so maybe then they go spend it at McDonald's or at Taco Bell or wherever. So there's the whole cyclical effect, like you said, the trickle-down thing. And does this ultimately help the company or not?
And what about other companies? What about McDonald's? What about Jack in the Box? What about In-N-Out?
You know, in a lot of places, they're being forced to pay more because of higher minimum wages, but also just to find enough people to keep restaurants open and running. And so in a lot of these cases, they are paying more, probably not $100,000 a year, but paying more and then raising menu prices as well. You know, a little bit here and there, you may not even notice, but your burger may be a nickel more, or your drink may be a little more than it used to be.
Well, I have read that In-N-Out pays its managers, on average, around $160,000 a year.
Yeah, well, they're private, so I guess we don't have a lot of info from them, but that wouldn't surprise me. I think, you know, In-N-Out has that cult following, like a Chick-fil-A or something, and they do pretty well with sales, so maybe they can afford to do that and still keep prices pretty reasonable.
So why is it that the fast food industry has been the target of this push to raise the minimum wage?
I think these people are very much in the spotlight. They're people that you know, other people see on a daily basis. It's a very tangible type job. And these people have been kept at pretty low wages, at minimum wage in a lot of cases for years and years. And in a lot of cases, again, this isn't really a living wage.
Right, exactly. It's what, $7.25 an hour, the federal minimum wage?
Correct. And I don't think it's changed in a long time.
Yeah. Well, okay. So you have Taco Bell with this idea. You have In-N-Out paying higher salaries. Panda Express has raised wages and offered employees stock options and continued education opportunities. So all of that, does that translate into people looking at fast food as like a good place to work?
Maybe eventually, but I don't think there's that change in attitude quite yet. I've also talked to some more of like the casual dining chains too, and they're being forced to pay a little bit more to get people to work in their kitchens, to, you know, an Applebee's or an IHOP or something like that. They need more people to assemble salads and cook chicken on the grill. They need actual cooks to do that sort of stuff.
And how much do they pay their cooks to do that?
You know, in some cases, we're seeing $20 an hour, so not terrible, and higher than it used to be. So I think demand is going up for those types of jobs, and so those people are going to ultimately end up making a little more. That being said, it's still not what most people would consider a high-paying job, but a little more than it used to be.
Well, overall, are these jobs worth $100,000 a year? Do they demand a skill level commensurate with that salary?
In a lot of cases, I would say yes. These are hard jobs. They're managing a bunch of people, a bunch of other people, you know, in some cases 20 or 30 other workers. They're responsible ultimately for scheduling, for keeping the restaurant up and running, for dangerous situations. You know, they're dealing with hot grills. People can get hurt very easily. They're dealing with food safety. It's a big deal. There's a lot of stuff that can go wrong in a Taco Bell. So, yes, I would think that these jobs are worth that much.
And there's a lot that can go right when you're eating at a Taco Bell. At least at a certain hour of the evening. Leslie Patton, she writes about food and restaurants for Bloomberg. Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's talk now about a potentially monumental new agreement between the WNBA and its female basketball players. The tentative plan gives top players the chance to make more than $500,000 in a season. And for the first time ever, the average salary would be above $100,000 a year. Players would also receive full salary during maternity leave, and they'd get childcare subsidies. Here is the commissioner, the WNBA commissioner, Kathy Engelbert, talking about the deal this week on NBA TV.
Really just redefining what it means to be a professional woman athlete who also might be a mom or an entrepreneur or, you know, whatever, you know, or an artist or a business person, and but also happens to be one of the most elite athletes and certainly the best women's basketball players in the world. So it was really important to put that whole package together for these women.
Well, LA Sparks forward Nneka Ogwumike is president of the Players Union, and she helped negotiate this deal. She joins me now. Welcome. Welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, so what is the top line here? The salaries seem to be, that seems to be a huge increase. Tell us the details there.
Yeah, so the salary, the max salary has basically doubled. And on average, players in the league will be making six figures. So there will be more players making an average of six figures. And you know, of course, we've been able to get everyone's vote to rise. You know, rookie scale goes up, minimum guarantee goes up, and the salary cap has increased to 1.3 from 996.
And how hard was it to strike this deal?
I wouldn't say it was hard. I think it was more tedious than difficult. To be honest, we just came in with open minds for both negotiations and, of course, a more broadened perspective of what we wanted to get done. Leading up into the opt-out and, of course, thus the negotiations, there's been much talk about salary and, more specifically, travel experiences with the players. So with that, we really gathered together as an EC and wanted to make sure that we holistically gained a lot from this new agreement.
So players had been going abroad to make more money or to make a decent living playing in Russia or China or Europe. Are they still going to have to do that, or will they stop doing that because their salaries are now more competitive?
I think that's, you know, up to the decision of the individual player. I think we're obviously moving towards opportunities for players in the off season so that they do have more options than just going and playing overseas, which has been such a big part of our livelihood with women in basketball. But we understand that in order for the league to grow, we must too. And right now it's looking like the more the opportunities there are in the off season, the more we'll have players in market and be able to truly get the partnerships that we need to continue to fuel resources into the league.
And part of this is also a revenue sharing agreement, right? So if the money the WNBA gets increases, you'll get more money as well.
Yes. Yeah, so right now we've structured a system in which the league has to attain a certain amount of revenue, which then kind of toggles the 50-50 split between the players and the league.
And how are they going to pay for this? Because, you know, NBA Commissioner Adam Silver has famously said that the WNBA was losing, on average, about $10 million a season. So how do you plan to reverse that?
I mean, I feel like that's probably more of a question for Kathy. But from my knowledge, you know, we have the league investing in us with the league marketing agreements to keep players in market. And, of course, the WNBA Changemakers is also another great announcement that was made in order for us to kind of foster the investors that we need to allocate resources to the WNBA.
So I guess what does that mean? Like how do you think as a player and a union leader, how do you think that you can contribute to the WNBA making more money?
I think by doing exactly what we did in the CBA, you know, speaking up and understanding that we want the league to grow, but also understanding that we can't continually do the same things over and over again. I think the more that we speak up as players within or outside of the agreement, it's really going to force challenges and obstacles and obviously gains and successions in how we operate as a league. Because quite frankly, you know, basketball is basketball, but you know, the WNBA is different from the NBA, and I think it's time that we assess exactly what works for us and move forward in that regard.
Yeah. So I guess that translates into getting more people excited about going to your games and going to see the games and spending money on tickets and on merchandise and all that stuff.
Yeah, and the players are doing their part in that regard. So, you know, it's on a lot of different organizations and corporations to provide the visibility and the access for people to come and watch us and, of course, the partnerships to give us the resources to fund the league.
Well, is it hard to get endorsement deals for you?
Individually, no.
Not for you, because you're a star.
Individually, no.
You're doing okay. But what about for other players?
For other players, it's difficult because the visibility isn't quite there. And so we wanted to come into the CBA agreement to give those players the opportunity to stay in markets, which is where the team marketing agreement comes into play. Of course, the league marketing agreements also come into play. But there are opportunities for players and I think that there could be more if we are able to, you know, tackle the business as it should. And quite frankly, you know, even as one of the top players, sometimes getting those marketing deals isn't as easy as people may think just because you're a top player.
What do you mean?
Well, you know, I think it has a lot to do with, of course, diversity and representation. And I think that the world right now is finally leaning towards those two things. And so as we are a mostly black league, it hasn't always been easy for women of color. And so for us to be able to make such a monumental agreement with a league with obviously mostly black women, we're very proud of that. And obviously there's more than just the racial diversity that we have in the league. We have players of so many different orientations and so many different backgrounds. We have mothers. And so I think that this agreement was exactly what we wanted. We wanted to shed light on so many different types of women in the workplace and playing basketball that can create that that resource that they need to perform at the highest level. And hopefully partners as well from the WNBA side and the business side can use that to get the resources that, you know, the WNBA needs to move in the right direction.
Another aspect of this really interesting is the full salary being paid during maternity leave and childcare subsidies. How important was that as part of your bargaining?
That was vital. And quite frankly, I'm not sure if we would have been able to do that without Kathy, because she came from Deloitte and had some monumental success with that in her previous business life. And so we were just really happy to be able to come with so many gains as far as motherhood and child planning goes for the players.
And do you think that this agreement will ripple out to other women's sports? Particularly, I'm thinking about women's soccer, which is in a legal battle with the U.S. Soccer Federation over pay equity and working conditions. Do you think that your agreement might spill over to help other athletes in other sports?
That's the perspective that we had going into the negotiations, is that we weren't just looking to fight for, you know, our own with the players in the WNBA. We wanted to fight for women in the workplace as well. And, of course, women in sports, more specifically team sports, because I think that team sports for women is where we see the most disparity between men and women in sports.
Well, congratulations and good luck on the court.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. Nneka Ogwumike, she plays for the LA Sparks, and she's president of the WNBA Players Association. Coming up, why playing with Legos as an adult could be good for your mental health. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. We are all overwhelmed with stress, be it from the job, the family, the social obligations, the news. And we deal with it in a lot of different ways. Maybe you crack open a bottle, or maybe you crack open an adult coloring book. An article in today's Washington Post highlights how the Danish toy company Lego is targeting the growing market of stressed out adults using the colorful plastic bricks as a form of mindfulness. Is there value and is there science behind unleashing our inner child and tapping into our creativity to deal with what life throws at us? We're going to talk about that now with Dr. Carrie Barron. She's the director of the Creativity for Resilience Program and a psychiatry professor at the Dell Medical School at UT Austin. Welcome.
Oh, thank you for having me, Madeline.
Well, what do you think of this idea of playing with Legos as adults as a way of reducing stress?
Yes, it makes a lot of sense. Play in general reduces stress. Adult play, letting the mind go free, letting the hands get engaged in a meaningful task. There's lots of benefits.
Right. Why Legos in particular, do you think?
Well, I think there's color is actually very useful. Florence Nightingale, the nurse in the Civil War, talked about using brightly colored objects to cheer or participate in the healing process for soldiers. So there is something about color. I think we have a very visceral response to it. But also, as much as we need time to let our minds go free and not be structured and be a little bit bored or have to reach inside to find direction, there is something very satisfying about following a set of directions and having a concrete product at the end produced. So when we're busy and we don't have enough time and we're all over the place, this sort of singular focus on this accomplishment, which is small but not really when you think about how it can affect the inner life. So yes, I mean, there are benefits.
Yeah. So you're saying that it's actually better to have one of those kits that tells you what to do and create a specific object than just making whatever comes to mind?
Well, it's a great question. I think it depends on who you are and where you are in your life. I mean, I'm a strong believer that all people are creative and that making things and following our intuition about lots of things in life, whether it's what we put on watercolors on a paper, even if we're not a painter, or words we choose. But, there are times when we need that structure, we need the predictability, and we need almost like a safe, contained experience. Mm. So I think it really depends on where you are and what you need at the moment. Sometimes just following a set of directions, it could be a recipe, and making a pie at the end or a cake can give you a feeling of pride, satisfaction. You know, that sigh, I did it. I've completed something. It's valuable.
Does that include playing a video game? You're using your hands. You're making decisions.
Yeah.
You're completing a task and creating something, I guess.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of satisfaction and even cognitive development that can come from that. I think, you know, there's something about the more tactile aspects of things like Legos, baking, the more we can use the more of our senses, the richer the experience. I think it offers some things that perhaps a video game does not, which isn't to say that video games don't offer things, because they do. It just, it needs to be sort of an either or one's good, one's bad.
Right. There's also kind of a secondary market, I guess, on TV for this, right? There's lots of crafting shows and baking shows. Like the idea, it might be very comforting for a lot of people, it seems to be, of watching other people do hands-on crafty things.
I know. There is something very interesting about that vicarious experience. I think I saw something in Denmark. There was a train that was just moving really slowly on a video for hours and hours, and people were watching that. I was fascinated by that. You know, maybe we feel connected to something very primitive and that we need in ourselves, the making. And when we see other people making, we're invited into that. It can create a mindset for us or encourage us to go and do it ourselves. But yes, I think you're right. I think the culture is speaking to us. You know, after the Industrial Revolution, we had the arts and crafts movement. And after this sort of advent or the acceleration of tech, we have a lot of interest in making and crafting because we need it.
So there is actual science behind that, right? There's research into the brain.
Yes. So, you know, Anaxagoras was a philosopher, an ancient philosopher, said the hand is the window to the mind, and science has really shown that. In med school, we are exposed to the homunculus, which is a little figure that represents the body's representation in the brain, and the hands are very large. They're disproportional compared to other parts of the body. So by using our hands, we stimulate the brain. We stimulate pleasure centers. There's also an effect on mood. Research has been done that shows that meaningful hand use, and that's a very individual thing, however you define that. I mean, it could be tending to your home or your garden, or it could be making a painting or playing an instrument, but whatever it means to you, meaningful hand use elevates mood.
Do you think there's something generational, I mean, current generational, about this with younger generations, Gen Z or millennials, and the way they're experiencing the world? They're much more digitally native. That's the term, I guess, that makes this perhaps a growing trend, that they are more interested in these kinds of activities than boomers or Gen Xers?
Right. So I think it's very interesting. You know, when I was young, for example, you know, I'm a baby boomer, we didn't have to be intentional about making. It was just required for everyday life. If you had a school party, you made the cookies and so forth. Now it's very easy to pick up wonderful things without effort. So I think, you know, there's a biological urge towards health, and I think that we seek a balance in the way that we move through the world, so that if we're a tech native and we're very immersed in that wonderful world, which is full of incredible possibilities for discovery, there might be a way in which we are craving a more grounded, visceral, primal experience of using our bodies and tactile experience, you know, the five senses in action can be a very gratifying experience. And I think people are moving, the younger generation, millennials and so forth, are moving towards it because I think we have a way always in the culture cultural trends, I think, are ways of expressing needs and what we need for balance.
Right.
And so
then we can post our Lego creation on Instagram and feel
complete. Right. Well, you know, there is something to the excitement and the novelty, to the sharing, to the connecting to other people, to being able to sort of document how you spent your day and to share that moment with people. It's a little bit interesting or a lot interesting for people who see it. I think that I'm not savvy enough in that particular trend of posting all the time and the psychological phenomena behind it, but it is what we do or what people do, and it gives them some sense of pleasure to do so. So,
all right, Dr. Carrie Barron, thanks so much.
Thank you.
All right, Michelle Alloy, you're here.
Hi.
With some feedback.
Yeah, we asked our listeners out there what they thought about this Bernie-Warren feud.
The lying
feud.
You're a liar. No, you're a liar.
Most people don't care. I liked this one comment. Theodore Arachiga says, even in 2020, there are people who do think that a woman should not be president. Bernie's comments probably had particular context, and she heard it in a particular way. This is how misunderstandings happen.
Okay. Mom and dad are fighting. Thank you, Michelle Loy. Thanks for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.